If you haven't got an outline, could I just be able to discuss the parcels around, please? I hate pulling the blinds to keep the sun out, but it highlights the picture a little bit more. That is a wonderful psalm, and it's all the richer when you think, when you sing it, as a number of us done, and David and Marion have done, up some of the big river valleys, where you sit beside the water and sing that and realise it was in a situation like that David had composed it. And remember, probably somewhere in the Engedi region where he was in danger of his life. Saul was chasing him. And what I'd really never noticed until a Jewish friend pointed out to me, we sing, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me. What the Hebrew says is, surely goodness and mercy shall chase me. Now think of that in context, because David is being chased by Saul. Thank you. And to write that, surely goodness and mercy, this is a God who is in hot pursuit of his people with love. You too will appreciate the richness of a very old rabbinic saying I find pastorally so very, very useful. The rabbis used to say, when you're in trouble, don't expect a miracle. Read the Psalms. Isn't there a richness in that? Because you've got the full range of, the full spectrum of life contained in these Psalms. Well, this morning, I want to invite you to come to a wedding. I wouldn't wear heels. Because where we're going, well, really, it is quite a unique location. It's a mountaintop wedding. And we'll begin by reading Exodus chapter 19. Exodus chapter 19, and we begin our journey at Mount Sinai. Remember, Exodus is actually a Greek word. It's made up of two Greek words, and those men who translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek, the Septuagint, they said the second book is about the way, hodos, out, X. In Hebrew, this book is called Shemot, because in Jewish tradition, books are called by the first major word in the text. And so this book, it's a lovely idea, Ba'ilei Shemot, and these are the names of those. Now think about it, because here is a book that is about a national redemption. It's about a liberation on a big scale, but the book name reminds you, individual names count. So they call it Shemot, or names. See, on the one hand, it's a big story. On the other hand, at the same time, individuals count. It's never biblically simply either or. You get both together. And I love this idea of Va'ilei Shemot, and these are the names. Names count in this book. And at chapter 19, in the third month after the Israelites left Sinai, on the very day they came into the desert, the wilderness of Sinai, the Midbar. After they had set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, and he said, "This is what you are to say to the house of Jacob, and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you in eagle's wings. I brought you to myself. Now, if you obey me fully, keep my covenant, then if out of all the nations you will be to me a treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation." And these are the words you are to speak to the Israelites. let's come to this mountain. It's fascinating, even just the tree, trace the theme of mountains right through the scriptures. As you really move from Mount Sinai through to Mount Zion, there is so much of biblical theology, the whole trajectory of God at work. And Revelation even ends up on a mountain where we come to Mount Zion. And isn't it very striking that possibly, and I know we don't tend to think this way, Eden was actually on a mountain. It was a mountain sanctuary. Because think about it, waters flowed from it. Now, unless you're from a very different part of the world than I am, water doesn't flow up a hill. And that wonderful kind of idea, when you read it, particularly in Ezekiel 38 and elsewhere, that idea of, you know, the water flowing from this mountain, temple, garden, sanctuary. It's a lovely idea. And water flowing down. Well, let's come to the mountain. And as we come to Sinai, and we come to the very heart of Torah, and at the heart of Torah there's a wedding. Now I never really thought this way until I kind of started to immerse myself in the Jewish background to the scriptures. And it has transformed the way I certainly read the Torah, and the way I read a book like Exodus. That when you come to see, and because there has been, as a legacy, you know, of a lot of Protestant interpretation, there has often been quite a negative view of Sinai. There's been this kind of heavy legal interpretation of it. And Luther, I mean, we're not being disrespectful about Luther, wonderfully brave man in his time. But he did kind of exacerbate this law and grace mentality, with the result we sometimes come back to these books and it's all, we read it as such legality, a heavy oppressive legality, that we can't really grasp what's going on here. So let's begin to look at this. Because at the heart of Torah is the beautiful picture of a wedding. Now, we need to back up a little bit and just look at the very word Torah itself. And it's a fundamental thing. And one way, it's tragic that in the year 2018 we should be having to do this. But certainly all over the Christian West, I suggest we really need to ask this fundamental question: what is Torah? Because very often, the popular answer has been Torah is law. Now, there is no question. Law is one of the ways it can be translated. But it is only one. Most emphatically, Torah is not simply law as we understand it. Law for me? Oh, I have a very vivid picture of law. Law has a freckled face. Law has a PSNI uniform. Law steps out on wee Desi at Antrim Forum and books me for doing 49 miles an hour in a 30-mile zone. Law's there to catch you when you're doing wrong. And we've got this impression that then, when we come, the law of the Lord, we tend, even sometimes with the best will in the world, kind of read a heaviness into that. This word Torah, the fascinating thing about Hebrew as a language is that it has verbal roots. Every word in Hebrew is derived from a verb. And the verb behind Torah is a verb yara. Yara means to fire an arrow. That you take an arrow, you line it up, you fire it off. And you try to get a bullseye. That's the idea. Yara, to give direction to an arrow. Interestingly, to this day in Israel, and some of you will really appreciate this, those of you who are teachers, the word for teacher in Israel is mohra. A mora is a lady teacher, mohre, man, but a mora is derived from yara. Because what are you doing, especially in primary school? You're taking children and you're putting them in the right direction. That's the very word that's used in Proverbs 1. My son, I want you to listen to the Torah of your mother. Mother wants lives to be on target. Mothers are not going to impose some heavy-handed, joyless legalism that robs us of all life and joy. Mothers want to give instruction, guidance, because they want life to be on target. And that's precisely the word that's used here. My son, I want you to listen to the guidance, the direction of your mother. She wants your life to be on target. And those of you involved, particularly in primary school teaching, you go away with a new vision of your role. You're not being directive. Of course not. But you are shaping lives and putting them on target. It's a phenomenal role, a phenomenal privilege. Talk about sending missionaries to Africa. We need to pray for them in our own classrooms, because they're doing wonderful, wonderful work, putting lives on target. So Mora, Torah, these are all derived, you see, from this word, Torah. There's nothing heavy-handed and legalistic about that. How could it be heavy-handed and legalistic? When you sing those words yourself, how I love your Torah. It's sweeter than honey. It's more precious than gold. When we get to the exciting part of this, this is God from the beginning saying, look, I want to put in a dark, fallen, alien, rebellious world, I'm taking one group, a segula, a treasured possession, and I want to point them in the right direction. I want them to live model lives. Now you know and I know, Israel didn't live up to that until the true Israel came in the figure of Jesus. But let's not take away from God's original purposes. The purpose of Torah, the purpose is for guidance, to give life, put it in the right direction, to allow a sanctity to marriage, to life, to value property, to give an esteem to work, and an egalitarianism that even Marx couldn't reach. Torah is a wonderful, wonderful idea. And it's there, foundational, in these first five books. It is a gift. Torah is quite distinct as a gift that God gave amongst the nations. And it's no wonder, and I've never ceased to be surprised how Christians are surprised by the fact that even in the Jewish prayer book it says its ways are the ways of grace and its peace and its paths lead to peace. You see, so often there has been a distorted, stereotypical misrepresentation of Jewish thought and of the Hebrew scriptures, because they've been turned into some heavy-handed Pharisaic legalism that somehow or another Gentile Jesus, meek and mild, came along and delivered us from. We've sort of distorted so much of what is in the scriptures. This is a delight. This is a joy. It's been given from the beginning. Its ways are ways of grace. And those ways of grace, you know, books like Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy are marinated by grace. They are wonderful books of grace when we begin to see them. So, look at the context here. Torah is inseparably bound to this geographical movement, where God is starting with Ur, bringing them into the land, down into Egypt, out of Egypt, into the wilderness, before re-entering into the land itself. We're right here in the middle of the wilderness, down here on the map, about Leviticus and where Numbers is. And when you look at these five books, now I know English grammar's changing all the time. Many of you will be, well, you're old enough to appreciate the grammatical rule that now has been thrown to the wind. Do you remember learning at school, you never, ever begin a sentence with "and"? That has changed. You see, it's become quite, and I don't know about you, but there's something still grates in me when I see it. The interesting thing is, what would be improper in good English grammar is totally acceptable in Hebrew grammar. Because what's very striking is that you see, when you look at the first five books of the Bible, the very first word in four of them is and. Genesis obviously doesn't begin with and, it begins in the beginning. But every subsequent book, although it's not evident in English, in Hebrew, Exodus begins, Va'ile, and these are the names. Leviticus begins, and he said. Now, it's maybe to overstate the obvious, but we tend to read the Bible in compartments. Do you know that one of the great words, I'm sure you've discovered it, it's one of the most popular words in Northern Ireland at the minute. Because everywhere I go, I discover it. It's probably the biggest word around. We. Going to a restaurant. You want a wee seat? There's a wee table. You want a wee menu? There's your wee bill. You want a wee dessert? I was with somebody recently, Dobie's for coffee. He was 6.5 feet, former policeman. And Gordon had got a big coffee. You know those really big ones? You know those big cups with the handles on either side you could take a bath in? We come up to the checkout and the girl looked at the coffee. She looked up at Gordon. He was he's big. Yeah, I have to take in oxygen to get up to him. He's big. And she looked down at the coffee again. Then she looked up at Gordon. Do you know that to this day I still can't believe this. She says, is that a wee big coffee you got? And then people go to church and say, wasn't that a wee man? Hadn't he a lovely wee word? And that was a lovely wee thought. And we take the Bible and we've reduced it to wee thoughts. And we've forgotten about the cosmic grammar. And the revelation of God on such a big scale. And the cosmic, the coherence of these books. These are not little individual fives. The ands indicate there is a flow. There is a narrative. There is a story. And we can't just divide them up. We've got to see them as a whole. So anything we look at is in the context of this unfolding drama. And as we do so, we're going to concentrate a little bit today around Exodus 19 and 20. And as we come to this Exodus, this great liberation, this way out, I want to suggest to you a very, for me, was a transforming way of looking at it. Do you know that in Jewish tradition, every Orthodox wedding to this day is based on the events at Mount Sinai? Now, look at the context. Israel is being brought out of Egypt. It is literally the Acts out Hodos way. Isn't it striking too in the Acts of the Apostles that the first believers were actually called the Hodos, the way? Isn't that a dynamic picture of being a believer? You know, there's nothing static about that. I'm on the way. I'm on a journey. I'm not stuck. I'm on the hodos. I'm on the way. To me, that's a wonderfully graphic picture. I'm on the way out. I'm on the way to freedom. When I think about Israel leaving Egypt, I always think there's the most wonderful... Do you ever hear the wonderful rabbinic parable about the big fat man and the wee donkey? The rabbis, you see, were masterly at telling stories. That's what parables are. Parables are stories. In many ways, they're a bit like political cartoons. You look, get the message very quickly, and you either laugh or you're offended. Parables, you know, there's this idea going, oh, you've heard this, I'm sure, earthly stories with heavenly meaning. I'm pretty uncomfortable with that idea. There's nothing heavenly about them. They're very earthly. Can you tell me a parable that you know the ending of? Did the Good Samaritan ever come back? Did the elder brother ever accept the other one eventually? Those guys who took their wages to arbitration because the boys that worked an hour were getting the same as the boys that worked for all day. Did they ever settle that? No, it's as if these stories are saying, you go and finish it. That's what parables do. They are invitations in to the work and the life of the kingdom. They are not some other worldly spirituality that's of no earthly practicality. Now, they had this masterly way of interpreting the scriptures in a way you never forget. And one day you see the big fat man was riding the little donkey, and the little donkey was saying, "Oh, my back. I wish he'd get off. He's killing me. Oh, my back." And the big fat man, who's sitting, the sweat's rolling off him, and he said, Oh, dear, I wish I could get rid of this beast. So uncomfortable. I can't just get anything. And this went on all day. The big fat man was saying, "I wish I could get off." And the wee donkey was saying, "I wish he'd get off," all day. And eventually they got to the village. And the big fat man, he got down. Oh, he says, "It's so good to get rid of that donkey." And the donkey stretched its back and said, "Oh, boy, am I glad to get rid of him." What historical biblical incident were the rabbis commenting on? You've read it, but maybe not from that angle. Because that's actually a Jewish parable predating Jesus about Moses confronting Pharaoh. Where Pharaoh, you know, the tension of, will I let them go or will I not let them go? And even when he did let them go, he was sorry. Oh, there was all. This is the way the rabbis think about the text. They paint pictures. This is why parables are like handles. Where if you live life without a handle, it's pretty difficult. But if you've got a handle to lift something up and carry it away. You see, you don't forget stories. You will forget some learned, erudite figure perambulating with alacrity through multisyllabic theological vocabulary. But you'll not forget the donkey. And you'll not forget the wee man. You see, we have turned theology into something that has become so dead at times. We've forgotten the excitement and the drama of the stories. And we've been robbed of life. So when we come to look at a story like this, this is where these rabbis at the time have this ability, very unique ability, to take these ancient texts and keep reapplying them. So as we come here, Israel's being set free. God sets them free. Now, look, we could spend a long time just on the Exodus itself. This, in many ways, is the great prototype for all liberation. There is something that is still so relevant in modernity as we look at God's ultimate act of liberation in the figure of Jesus. Because what happens in Exodus is his prototype. But we're going to go to a place for a little while this morning that actually, well, it's a place that I want you to come with me, because in my experience over the years, and it's limited, but I've discovered an awful lot of Christians have never been there. And I think it's a wonderful place. And it's a place God intended to take Israel. It's an enormously liberating place, and it's called freedom. But it's striking, the number of people who've never been there. Because when we come to look at freedom, if you had been an ancient Israelite stepping out of Egypt, you've just crossed the Red Sea, You were stepping out into the great unknown. Now that's sometimes the scary bit about walking with God. When in obedience you take a path that's a little bit maybe different than somebody else's. When the route to obedience takes you into an unknown territory. It's not inappropriate to use the word risk. Except in our case, we're taking that risk knowing we're doing it in obedience to God. Abraham Heschel puts it beautifully when he says, obedience always comes before understanding. And that's stepping out into the great unknown. It's scary. It's scary. No wonder Abraham Heschel wrote about this and called it the insecurity of freedom. Because you're stepping out into something that is uncharted territory. We haven't been there before. This is unknown to us. So what's sometimes the human reaction to this? Oh, the way we'll cope is we'll create rules. Do you know one of the fascinating things is if you ever go to Israel, on all the Christian sites, and by Christian sites, I mean those under the control of either the Roman or the Orthodox Church. It is only when you go to the Christian sites, and on every one of the Christian sites, as you enter, the first thing you'll see, you'll not wear this, you'll not eat this, you'll not do this. That's striking. The first sign at virtually every Christian site is, thou shalt not. And how many think that's a picture of being a believer? As the cynic says, oh, church, that's the place those Christians go to develop all their negatives. What a distortion. You know, God saves you so that you'll not do this, not do that, not do the other. One of the great ironies is you go to one of the great baptismal sites. And what's the sign say? Going down to the water's edge is forbidden. You tell, huh? How many, but the tragedy, through the humour of this, the tragedy is, how many got that impression of what it is to be God's people? Where it's simply, you know, with kind of the mentality, what does it mean to be in Northern Ireland? Good living. Well, he doesn't do this, he doesn't go there, he doesn't talk to them, he doesn't wear that. Isn't it a travesty? Isn't it such a travesty at times? Because we think a rule book is the answer. And it is such a distortion that many people's view of the Christian life, it's walking a tightrope. It is a joyless, insecure experience for so many. I'm not saying for all, but for so many. Do you know, it was in the wilderness I learned one of the most fundamental lesson about the nature of freedom. And I learned it straight from a horse's hoof. We were looking one day in the depths of the Negev, in the very heart of the Negev, where they are breeding wild horses again. And by good fortune, we came across a herd of them. And we stood and watched them for quite a while. And then I said to my guide, and I said, Arthur, this may seem stupid. I know it may seem absolutely stupid. But here I am, look, I'm looking out onto this vast, vast area. These horses are free. And I see paths. In my mind, if they're free, surely they could be running anywhere. Ah, but he says, Desi, remember, these horses are not shod. If they split a hoof, expose a nerve, not only will it endanger them getting to food, but more importantly, they'll not get to water. They'll die. They have learned that along these paths, there's less likelihood of stones. So isn't there a, and they'll stick to these paths. Isn't there a profound lesson for you to unpack here? That freedom, you see, is never license. Freedom is not doing just whatever you want. But freedom is enjoyable and exercised by following what we believe to be the God-given paths. Paths that are given to put us in the right direction, that we can enjoy freedom. Hence these very 20 words that he, or 10 words that he gives in Exodus 20. You know, usually in the West, when we're asked, what are the ten words, the Ten Commandments, we usually begin, thou shalt not. If you go into any synagogue, and if you see any Jewish representation of the two tablets, do you know what the first one is? The first one is always taken directly from Exodus 20. Anoki Adonai, I am the Lord your God who set you free. It doesn't begin with thou shalt not. It begins, I am the Lord who set you free. In the course of enjoying that freedom, where you will respect truth, you will respect the integrity of marriage, you will have the freedom to rest. You will not live life always wondering what somebody else has. I've set you free. To enjoy that freedom. God brought them out to set them free. So when we look at their experience, you see, can I suggest to you, as we look even at these wild horses and as we look at the wilderness, we have so much to learn, even today, about enjoying that freedom. Knowing there are times, yes, we've got to say no. There are boundaries we cannot, we dare not cross before God. But there's a world of difference in knowing where to draw the line. And living simply on a joyless tightrope, so characterized by negativity and kind of a fundamentalist legalism, that is radically different from the joy-filled, God-centered freedom that he has given his people. He set them free to bring them out. He gives them the freedom to belong. He brings them to himself. Do you ever notice the language? Again, look at the geography. When you look at it, he's brought his people from Pharaoh's land, from under the totalitarian regime, the tyrant, to no man's land. From Pharaoh's domain into God's domain. But above all, look, do you notice Exodus 15, verse 16? That's a very, very important chapter. It's the Song of the Sea. We need to learn that. Because that song is the song, remember, they've only ever given rehearsals of it. What happened at the Red Sea was only a rehearsal when they sang the Song of the Sea. The command performance is yet to come. Because in Revelation 15, the Song of Moses becomes the Song of the Lamb. And we celebrate the ultimate exodus, the ultimate deliverance that God gives his people. But in the middle of Exodus 15, you know that great word? You know, they sing, until your people, O Lord, pass by, until the people you have bought, you have purchased, you have acquired, pass by. God has brought them. And where did he bring them? According to the text, he doesn't simply bring them. Exodus 19, he doesn't just bring them to Sinai. He brings them to himself. He doesn't just bring them to a place. He brings them to himself. And there, you get one of the most lucid insights into the nature of the relationship that he wants with his people. A marriage. Because there, you have a marriage covenant being established at Sinai. A relationship of intimacy, of responsibility, of mutuality, of reciprocity, and of love. Where God enters into that relationship. This is what happened at Sinai. It is a veritable marriage. Even Ezekiel looked back on it. Remember where he says, I made my vow to you and entered a covenant with you. Here is the Lord himself speaking of this relationship. He is the lover. This is not the impassible, unmoved mover, first cause of Greek philosophy. This is the lover. This is the warrior. This is the King. This is the Father. This is God according to God, not according to theologians. This is God who enters into this relationship. We have categorized him, classified him. We have put him into theological categories. And we have lost something of the awe and the power and the majesty and the infinity of this transcendent God, who in his transcendence draws near in imminence to Mary's people. Now what takes place here? Well, to this day, if you ever got to an Orthodox wedding, it will take place under a canopy, chuppah. That chuppah is meant to represent the fact that Exodus 19, and the glory cloud came down. The glory cloud, the Shekinah, the presence of the Lord came down on that place. Isn't that a lovely picture of a wedding? Where a wedding takes place under the brooding presence of the glory of the Lord. The chuppah can represent the future home, or it can represent the glory presence. But that's a lovely picture of marriage, and the celebration of marriage taking place under the chuppah, where God and Israel come together. Surely, surely, it shouldn't be lost on us that Jesus chose a wedding as the launching pad for his own public ministry. It was launched in the context of the celebration of life. And the joy of it, where Jesus entered into the fabric of life and the celebration of life and of marriage. So there's this glory presence. There is also in Exodus 19 a ritual cleansing. Because they are told, Moses is told, go and cleanse the people. And to this day, of course, in Jewish thought, ritual cleansing, the mikveh, the immersion chamber, ritual immersion is very, very significant. A bride is to go and cleanse herself as the groom before the wedding. Then at this wedding in Exodus, there's also a written document. Long before prenuptial agreements at Hollywood and California, the Bible was into prenuptial agreements, because Moses brought down, remember, the written covenant, the tablets, the words of freedom. And to this day in Jewish tradition, a wedding is based on a ketuvah, literally a written document. And that's what surely we have in the text of Scripture. Above all of it is a ketuvah. It is a wonderful written contract establishing the nature of covenantal marriage, the intimacy of marriage. And then, just a few chapters on, by Exodus 25, you've got the marital home. Because the God who was at the top of the mountain comes down the mountain into the marriage home. Do you see the setting of the tabernacle here? It's at the bottom of the mountain. Without ever taking away from his transcendence, his holy otherness, he comes down as an immanent God to be with his people. The very concept of God making his home in the context of covenant and of relationship. See the intimacy that's here in the wilderness. And as we look at that, and I have found a phenomenal challenge at times, to try to see things through. I've been more and more kind of trying to understand Jesus in his Jewish context. I think it's tragic for many. Jesus has been turned into a little Gentile who parachuted into the Reformation as a wee prod. We have lost sight of Jesus in his Jewish context. We have lost sight of the richness and the meaning of Jesus as Messiah. It's time to restore the real roots of our faith, to come back to the real majesty of the revelation of this book. And as we do so, and as we see Jesus, and as we see things through those lenses at times, what struck me very, very forcefully, listen to Abraham Heschel writing about God's relationship with Israel. What obtains between God and Israel must be understood not as a legal, but as a personal relationship, as a participation, an involvement, intention. And then he goes on. Now, I find this next sentence one of the most challenging sentences I ever find in literature. And I think if an Orthodox Jew can write this, what should a Christian be able to write? What should a new covenanter, indwelt by the Spirit of God, indwelt by the Spirit of the resurrected Lord, be able to say? God's chosen sphere is that of covenant. His relationship to his partner is one of benevolence and affection. Where have we got to a stage in so many preaching circles we think, boy, did he give it to them today? And we think it hasn't been a good sermon unless the flames of hell have licked round them and they leave feeling like little dogs with their tails between their legs because they're never good enough, they're never praying enough, they're never doing enough. And we've got to that stage. We go, oh, that's humility. No, it's not. It's humiliation. There's a world of difference. Humility? Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking more of God, as Dwight Pryor said. There's a world of difference. How do we belittle that which has been made in the image of God? That which bears its very image. Oh, I'm not going soft on sin. Of course not. I recognize the reality of it. We're not going soft on that at all. But we become at times so fixated on sin, so fixated on the judge, that we actually forget about the grace and the mercy. We're not talking personally now here, we're thinking on a wider scale. What's going on out there? And the distorted misrepresentation of who God is. You ever notice the 13 attributes in Exodus chapter 34? It's called the 13 attributes. Sometimes Martin Luther called it the Sermon on the Name. The Lord. Moses had just prayed, show me your glory. And then the Lord comes down. And yeah, at the end it does say, yeah, I often think of it as a big train. And at the end, at the beginning, there's the two big engines. The Lord, the Lord. And at the end, there's the guard van. He will not suffer. He will not let the guilty go unpunished. But before you get to the guard's van, do you notice how many carriages there are? Of grace, and love, of compassion, of mercy, of love. Sometimes we're so busy getting to the guard's van, we forget about the grace. Look at the intimacy. His relationship is one of benevolence and affection, where God's life interacts with the life of the people. This is the God who comes down to be with his people, to dwell with them. The very verb that's used here, it's an interesting verb, shakan, that actually really connotes putting your tent in the midst of people. From the verb, you get the noun, mishkan. So if you were to read Exodus 25, verse 9, it literally says, make this mishkan for me. You see what's happening here? You see the bigger part? This is only part of a bigger trajectory. Because this God, who had come down to dwell in the garden, come palace, come sanctuary, come temple in Eden, this is the same God who comes down now into the Mishkan. This is the same God who will come down into the temple. This is a God who keeps coming down. And I found it a phenomenal challenge when a Jewish physicist one day, sitting over coffee in Hervey Square in Jerusalem, says to me, he says, you Christians, he says, tell me, where in your Bible do you get all this idea about everybody going up? Because, he says, the more I read my Bible, the more I find a God who comes down. Who comes down into the garden, into the tent, who comes down into the temple, who comes down in Jesus, who comes down in the Spirit, who will come down in a new Jerusalem to a new creation. Why is it that seemingly so many, particularly a lot of stuff that's been imported from a particular school of hermeneutics in North America, is all about going up? When the Bible has so much to say about coming down. about a God in search of his people. Look at Exodus. Remember I've said to you, there's the and. Look, and I'm not terribly into statistics, but look at the proportion of the Torah that's given to the God who comes down. In the forward movement, you discover from about Exodus 19 through to Numbers 10 is all devoted to this sanctuary. Isn't that very striking? When you move through, of 58 chapters in the forward movement, 43 of them relate to the tabernacle, the God who comes down. One third of Exodus, one third of Numbers, all of Leviticus is about this sanctuary. You have in the opening of your Bible 34 verses about the creation of the cosmos. You have 40 chapters about a God who comes down. And yet, where are most Christians preoccupied debating about where dinosaurs fit in? Or is it 24-hour literal days? And we become so preoccupied by, in a sense, pettifogging arguments that we lose the big message of the whole book. It's about a God who comes down. And when he comes down, what is so evident here, he didn't come down just to take them up. He didn't bring them out of Egypt to go up. He brought them out of Egypt to go forth and to go out and to go on with him. It's so obvious. He brought them out so that they would be free to serve. Free to serve. When you look at Exodus, exactly the same verb is used of serving Pharaoh as is used of serving God. Why is it that when they're serving Pharaoh, it is slavery? When they're serving God, it's an expression of freedom and liberty. What's the difference? It's one word in Hebrew. It gives us in English one word. In modern English, we have a word for work. We have a word for worship. In biblical Hebrew, they have one word, avodah, that means both work and worship. It's a lovely idea that here, as they crossed the Red Sea, they were transferring their sense of belonging from under one master, who was a totalitarian ruler, who was a tyrant, who used them just as production machines, to another whom they could serve and express freedom. I think it's one of the wonderful, most wonderful words in the Bible, avodah, service, that you serve this God. It's not that you serve him to impress him, but that you serve him, in other words, to express your gratitude. He sets us free to serve. And one final thing, he sets them free to be changed. As he brings them out, the language, there's such parallelism between the language of creation and the language of the Exodus. Striking. The words are very, very similar. Just one thought. What do we read in Exodus or in Genesis? In Genesis, God broods over the creation. Exactly the same pictures used in Deuteronomy. You see the language in Deuteronomy? He found Israel, he found him in a desert land, in a wilderness, in a howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him, he cared for him. What did he do? He spread out his wings. It's exactly the same imagery as in Genesis 1, of a brooding presence. And actually, it's striking that the word that Moses in Deuteronomy uses of the wilderness is exactly the same word that was used back in Genesis 1. The Spirit brooded over the tohu va tohu, the nothingness, the meaninglessness. And so God brings them out to the wilderness to what? He set them free so that he would brood over them. And what we would get where there'd been that waste and disorder, then he brings an act of redemptive recreation. And it's a wonderful picture. He brought them out. And here's the real challenge. Do you know, in a sense, without being irreverent, getting them out of Egypt was nothing in comparison to getting Egypt out of them. How many of God's people today face the same challenge? Subjected to that redemptive, ongoing recreation activity of the Spirit of God within us. And sometimes putting us in hard places. Not because he wants to punish, but because he wants to transform. Do you remember what Ben-Gurion had said about the wilderness? It's in the wilderness, it's in the Negev, that the creativity of the pioneer vigor of Israel shall be tested. What a wonderful way to see today. Not wishing trials, tests, pain on anybody, but to certainly issue a salutary corrective to a lot of that cliched nonsense that goes around today. Come to Jesus and everything's going to be well. Come to Jesus and you'll have health and wealth and everything is going to be happy. We need something that robustly can deal with that and assure people. Challenge, pain, suffering. These are not signs of God's abandonment. These are the very places where he's going to be with you. And we'll see that this evening. What a wedding. And it's not over yet. Because Revelation takes us to the consummation of that wedding, to a feast that's yet to come. Almighty Father, when we stand in awe before a plan that is so awesome, so cosmic, so transcendent, so majestic, and yet to realize you enter into the intimacy, the mutuality of relationships with us as people, may we marvel. Continue to draw us to yourself, that we may love you more and experience the reality of that ongoing redemptive recreation, that changing power of God within our lives. Come down your secret stairway, even now this morning, where there's need of healing, where there is need of comfort, where there's, well, your spirit may live up to the name of Paracletus, drawing alongside us as comforter. Maybe as challenging. Come and make this time together a time of redemptive recreation where the Spirit will brood over what we do and that the Word again will be creative and dynamic. Through Jesus we pray. Amen. I apologise, I've lost all track of time.
When were we supposed to end?
Oh, no, that's fine, okay. Sorry, I've lost the whole track of that.
One more.
Press this red button, Callum. Press the red button.
It's just going to be a wee cup of tea now, so yeah. Hang around, just Stay for a wee minute for a wee cup of tea.
Sorry.
That's probably not. That's okay.